We present at this time the regular Sunday afternoon address of Father Charles E. Coughlin from Royal Oak, Michigan.
Gentlemen, it will be my privilege to present Father Coughlin in his Mother's Day message. As you know, it is Father Coughlin's intention to continue broadcasting throughout the summer months. Professedly, he not only opposes Nazism as to all persons in this nation, but he is also opposed to communism, which unfortunately millions of persons support either directly or indirectly. These broadcasts, therefore, support Christianity and Americanism, and oppose the advances of irreligion and state supremacy, which masquerades under different foreign isms. Approximately 9 of the 48 stations of this network can carry only the first half of this program. The reason for this is related to commitments made previously by the stations to other programs. We congratulate them for their cooperation. For the past 2 Sundays, the popular station WINS of New York City has been carrying this program. We wish our millions of listeners in the New York area will bear this in mind and give support to this station in its activities. May I now present to you Father Coughlin in The Mother's Challenge to Warmongers.
Good afternoon, my friends. This is the day when the mothers of America exercise their right of speaking to the sons and daughters of our nation. Well may they speak. Well may we, their offspring, listen. Long enough have we attended to the words which drop from the lips of those who have spoken of things that pierce the hearts of American mothers. Long enough have we listened to the apostles of war. My friends, motherhood is essentially concerned with life in all its abundance. War with death and devastation. Motherhood is the fountain whence springs the waters of love and happiness. War is the stagnant cesspool of hate and misery. The barren waste of filth whence seeps the sordid aftermath of poverty and national strife. Today there stands in bold relief the resplendent figure of your mother and my mother, challenging the deceitful sophistries which drop from the lips and pens of those who prize more dearly the gains of greed than they do the preservation of the flesh and blood cradled by the mothers of mankind. Why, therefore, should not those whom we honor with the title of mother raise their voices to defend their sons, whom the prince of darkness would devour? Alas, although their hearts beat bravely in defiance of those whose lance of propaganda would drench the earth with the last drop of their son's blood in behalf of Mammon, although they cannot speak in unison, may I presume to be a spokesman for them, at least for those who are tortured by the thoughts of war, tortured by the prospect of their son's untimely death. What a paradox this is in which we live. We who establish clinics to save life clinics to abolish tuberculosis, cancer, infantile paralysis, clinics to facilitate the birth of childhood and the preservation of our younger generation. What a paradox it is to find us devising ways and means disguised by the thin veil of propaganda to end life on foreign soil for the purpose of defending a lie and protecting the unclean gains of those who conceived the lie. Oh, if our mothers could speak, they would tell us that the sons of other mothers dwelling in other countries are not our enemies. Not so much, perchance, as those who dwell within our own borders, within the borders of every nation. I mean those men who long since have regarded their fellow citizens as cannon fodder. Those men who cast aside the doctrine of the communion of saints, the brotherhood of Christ, the fatherhood of God, and in their stead have accepted the crass philosophy of materialism, of naturalism, of racial predominance. Oh, yes, with glamour and fanfare, they regiment the youth of every nation, drill them in the fine arts of murder, inspire them with the brute emotions of savagery, and then send them off to join in the carnival of death. When the last sad requiem is sounded over the last shattered corpse on a battlefield, these conspirators who are powerful enough to fetter the process of government forget the promises which their propagandists made, desecrate the memories and the sacrifices of the slain, spurn the veterans who fought to make the world safe for democracy, while new laws are legislated to safeguard the clippers of coins, the breeders of more wars. Sons who have returned from battle seldom complain, but their mothers know how these same sons were compelled to march the streets searching for jobs which did not exist, searching in vain, only to lose faith in government, sometimes in God, and cast aside the virtues, the prayers, the love taught them at their mother's knee. Recently, I was privileged to read a book entitled Days of Our Years, by Pierre Van Passen, a book published by Hillman Curl, Incorporated of New York, a book that deserves wide circulation. Van Passen, one of the world's eminent foreign correspondents, discloses for us a sordid drama enacted by the French Republic. In the days of our years, we read how French heroes were treated as traitors by the government they served. How mothers' sons were massacred not by the Boche in opposite trenches, but by the very officers under whom they fought. I feel constrained to read for you the untold horror of war, which for 20 years or more has remained hidden. A story which may be revived to become our story unless we heed the mother's challenge to America, which bids us hold ourselves aloof from future wars. Mr. Van Passen says, to this day, the general public in France remains unaware of the fact that thousands of Frenchmen were shot down by their comrades during the war, without a single serious charge being leveled against them. Many were executed on being designated by lot and by pure chance. Take, for example, the case of one Lucien Berceau, a middle-aged peasant who served in the 60th Regiment of Infantry. His retrial was one of those held in the Cherche Midi. The periodical, Crapouillot, was the only publication in Paris that gave a resume of the court proceedings. It was established that one day in the winter of 1915-16, Berceau had asked his corporal for a pair of cloth trousers because it was extremely cold, and whereas all his comrades were warmly dressed, he alone in the company wore a tattered pair of cotton slacks. The corporal took Berceau behind a field hospital, and picking up a pair of trousers which had just been pulled off a dead man, told him to put on the garment. Berceau took the trousers and held them up for inspection. Clots of blood dropped from the legs. "That poilu must have lost his entrails entirely," remarked Berceau, referring to the garment's former owner. "No, I don't want it. I don't want that thing." An officer, Lieutenant Andre, happened to pass by at the moment. "What's going on here?" inquired the superior. "This man asked for a pair of trousers," replied the corporal. "I gave him a pair and he refuses to put them on." "Refuses?" scowled the officer. "Refuses an order? Quick, my man, put on that pair of pants. Quick! Do you hear?" "Mais, mon lieutenant, the thing is soaking wet with blood. Put on those trousers, I tell you." "You put them on yourself and see how you like it," laughed Berceau. "A French citizen does not need to walk around in a dead man's filth." "8 days arrest," barked Lieutenant Andre, for refusal to obey. "Ça va?" Berceau shrugged his shoulders. "But I keep my old slacks." The colonel of the 60th Regiment saw the report a few days later. "That's mutiny," he declared. "Those fellows are getting out of hand. Call a court-martial at once. I'll set an example of discipline." All this was put in evidence at the retrial in the Cherche Midi. The company, witnesses recalled, was thrown into consternation by the colonel's decision. Two soldiers, Dumoulin and Cote, went to see Lieutenant Andre to ask him to modify his charge. Monsieur Perruche de Vernat, who had been recorder at Berceau's court-martial at the front, continued the story at the retrial. He says, "It was the 12th of January, 1916. We were near the chateau of Mardanson on the left bank of the Aisne. Colonel Larue summoned me to headquarters and said, 'Sergeant, I asked you to come because I'm faced with an open rebellion. I must set some examples. I must kill one or two of these fellows. Of course, I expect to observe the rule. That's understood. You are a recorder on the permanent court martial of the division. You're a magistrate in civil life. Well, you know what I want. I need a formula. Find it." The colonel handed me Berceau's file, went on Monsieur de Vernat. There was nothing in it but a sheet of paper, Lieutenant Andre's report of the incident behind the field hospital. At the end of this report, Andre had written that Berceau's comrades had asked him for leniency.
"You see," exclaimed the colonel, "you see, just as I told you, open rebellion by the men, refusal to obey on the part of Berceau."
I drew the colonel's attention very respectfully to the fact that if Berceau's comrades had made a mistake, for it's against military regulations to make a collective complaint, this certainly did not amount to rebellion. Insofar as Berceau was concerned, it was impossible to charge him with disobedience. Before a charge of refusal to obey can be laid against a man, a service order must be issued. I told the colonel that he was going too far when he demanded a death sentence for a man's refusal to put on a pair of dirty trousers.
All right, answered the colonel. Let the others be charged with an infraction of the regulations, but Burso shall be charged with the refusal to carry out orders in the presence of the enemy. Draw up an order of accusation in that sense. After all, it's I who command here. Moreover, he added, I'm going to preside over the court myself. At these words, continued the recorder, I could not conceal my amazement. Surely, sir, you're not thinking of anything as drastic as that. You are the prosecutor in this case. You cannot at the same time sit in judgment. Neither in civil law nor in military law can one and the same person be judge and accuser. I'm going to preside, were the colonel's only words. The session of the court-martial was held a few minutes later in a dugout. The three judges were Colonel LaRue, his private secretary, the regimental sergeant major, and one of the other officers. One of the two soldiers who had spoken up for Burseau, one was acquitted, the other sentenced to hard labor for life. Burseau was sentenced to death for disobedience in the name of the sovereign people of France. At dawn the next morning, the poor man was taken from his cell by the padre. He wept quietly and mumbled, oh, but this is not possible. I must... For a pair of dirty pants? No, c'est pas possible. This must be a joke. A thing like this is impossible in France. The impossible sometimes happens in military matters, added Monsieur de Vernon, his testimony. The justice of the military tribunal is not like ours. Well, Burseau was taken a few hundred yards up the road, led into a farm courtyard. The colonel had arrived before. He was freshly shaven and dressed in his best uniform. Burseau's eyes were bandaged, and in his hands, tied behind his back. When the colonel gave the order to the firing squad to take aim, the condemned man screamed, Marie Louise! Marie Louise! That was his only child, Monsieur de Bellin explained. The special court of retrial in the Cherche Midi, in pronouncing sentence in this case, declared as follows. Whereas on the one hand, Colonel LaRue had signed the order of inculpation and yet presided at the session of the court-martial, and whereas on the other hand, the order given to Burseau was not a service order for the accomplishment of a military duty, the sentence of the court-martial is hereby annulled. Annulled, I add, after the man was murdered by his own officers. Madame Burseau, Mr. Van Patten continues, who had been present at the trial of revision and who had addressed a letter to the public press telling of the years she had been the object of disdain in the Breton village where she resided as the widow of a traitor, decided to press charges against Colonel LaRue. However, the Minister of War, André Maginot, the builder of the Maginot Lines, had the charge quashed. Further, he decorated Colonel LaRue with the cravat of a commander of the Legion of Honor. A few days after this pathetic incident came to light, Crapouillot reported how another trial, held in Metz, an ex-officer had calmly declared in court the general of Vaillac on March 7, 1915, had ordered his artillery to take under fire a trench full of French soldiers merely because their company had been thrown back the previous day when they had launched an attack on the German position at Sueil. When the artillery commander refused to carry out this murderous instruction without a signed order from Ravaillac, the general compromised. He demanded the names of any four corporals and any 18 men belonging to the company, and order them sent out into no man's land to cut the barbed wire in plain daylight. The general obviously expected a protest on the part of the soldiers designated, and a refusal to carry out the insane order. But there was no refusal. The men went out, and were, of course, immediately taken under fire by a dozen German machine guns. They threw themselves into the shell holes and did not move until nightfall, when they cut the wires and returned to the trenches. The next day, all were up for court-martial on the charge of having displayed cowardice in the presence of the enemy. The four corporals were executed. Two of them were only wounded by the first salvo of the execution squad. The officer commanding the squad had just given these two wounded men the coup de grace with his service revolver when Ravaillac's order arrived calling off the execution. And I may add, these men were murdered by their own officer. The story continues. The revisional court rehabilitated the men. A monument was elevated to their memory at Sartilla in the department of the Manche by Monsieur Raymond Poincaré, the president of France, who for 7 years of his tenure of office unveiled a monument to the dead every Sunday. He did not unveil this one. Poincaré made General Ravaillac, who was the owner of a chateau of a rich wine-growing estate in the south, a grand officer of the Legion of Honor. Then there was the affair of Villeray, which came up for revision on July 24th, 1929, before the special court. It was but one of the endless numbers of retrials going on all over France. In this case, a company of infantry belonging to the 45th Brigade appeared to have grumbled against an order to attack after digging trenches 48 hours in a torrential rain. All the surviving witnesses were unanimous in declaring that there was not a dry cartridge in the company. Every man, said one witness, was a ball of mud with a rifle sticking out. The artillery had not cut the barbed wire, so that it was obvious that the attacking column would be compelled to flatten out immediately after going over the top. 350 corpses still lay in the trench to remind the men what had happened 3 days earlier when their company had tried to attack from the same spot. And eventually, lots were drawn for the 6 men who had to face the divisional court-martial. The first man to be questioned was Corporal Morange. He admitted frankly that he had not climbed over the top because it wasn't his company's turn. What had happened? The session was declared closed without a decision having been reached, and the next day at dawn, however, the padre was sent to inform the 6 that they were going to be executed. "But this is a crime," exclaimed Lieutenant Minot, the counsel for the defense. "The court martial has not even pronounced a sentence." "And what had happened?" I asked. "Well, in the night, the divisional commander, who had an interview with Joffre..." Joffre, as usual, had a recommend of the utmost severity. The old generalissimo, whom the newspapers called Grandpa, was a firm believer in the system of decimation as a purely disciplinary measure to keep an army well in hand. For weeks, for months, for years, in every departmental courthouse, these investigations of which I have been reading to you in France, these investigations into the validity of the wartime court-martial continue, always ending with the same sad result. Innocent men, my friends, have been assassinated on the slightest whim of superior officers, who in the majority of cases were not front-line soldiers themselves. Is not that an astounding story of war? War that dresses up your son's mother in the uniform of a patriot. War that follows him into the trench, makes him dwell with vermin, makes him the companion of rats, makes him the father of the machine guns. Sometimes held in the hands of the officers of his own army. Mothers of America, we, your sons, are no cowards. For this, our land, gladly we would give our lives. But to sacrifice them on the altar of hate, of murder, and of lust for gold. Oh, no. Rather would we spend our lives toiling for the sons of other mothers. The 12 million jobless whom the cruel man-made oppression has exploited. Millions of little children in our midst, who in a land of plenty have been told that there's no room for them or their mothers in the inn. The gospel of motherhood is the gospel of love and of life. Under international capitalism and its interminable wars, there has been foisted upon us the heresy of hate and of death. As a result of this, the entire world has sustained an irreparable loss. Religious convictions have been outmoded. Virtue too often has surrendered to vice. In government, in industry, in homes, and in individuals. Our efforts to make the world safe for democracy have made it temporarily safe for hypocrisy. Oh, has not the hour arrived for those of us who yet retain an admiration for the gospel of love and life, imprinted upon our youthful minds by our mothers? Has not the hour arrived to make this world safe for motherhood and for the sons whom they bore? Safe for decency, safe for virtue, safe for peace, safe for life. And safe for the little children loved by their mothers throughout the world. The mother's challenge to the warmongers has been made to every son in America. Will it be accepted? Most certainly. For today we stand and pledge to the mothers who bore us to return to the pathways of the Prince of Peace whom we've deserted. Oh, remember, thou mother of mankind, that never was it known that anyone who fled to thy protection as we do to thine, implored thy help and sought thine intercession, was left unheeded. Inspired, mother of Jesus Christ, with this confidence, we fly unto thee, O Virgin of Virgins, our Mother. To thee we come, before thee we stand, sinful and sorrowful. O
mother of the Word incarnate, of the Prince of Peace, despise not our petitions, but in thy mercy, hear and answer us. Amen.
Copies of the address to which you have listened are available to all persons in this audience. Simply write a letter to Father Coughlin at Royal Oak, Michigan. The main facts related to the second part of the broadcast, soon to follow, will be found in next week's edition of Social Justice Magazine. And now, once again, I present Father Coughlin in his thought for the week.
Nowhere in the world is there revealed more conspicuously the virtue of patience than in the lives of our mothers. By patience, I mean the ability to suffer. It was in suffering that our mothers brought us into existence. It was through sacrifice that she nursed us during our tender years of boyhood. All through our childhood, it was necessary for our mothers to forget their own leisure and pleasure, to spend upon us the exacting care which we demand. Most sons and daughters understand how heavy rests the crown which nature places upon the brow of a devoted mother. True, there are compensations for her long hours of labor. But what public recognition do we give our mothers beyond the passing tribute of this day? We sons and daughters have been inclined throughout the ages to build monuments to our national heroes. At the close of a sanguinary war, a tomb is builded and a lamp is lighted for an unknown soldier. Were it not as appropriate for American sons and daughters to build a monument to the unknown mother? She would be a symbol of every American heroine who brought life into the world. She would be your mother and my mother, representing the millions of queens who reign supreme, each in the kingdom of her home. And such a monument would have sculptured upon it the fitting reminders, not only of the mother who nursed us in infancy, who molded us in boyhood, and joyed with us in the strong maturity of our years. Oh, no, it would be incomplete. Did it not represent a motherhood with her stooped shoulders, her gray hairs, her wrinkled brow, alone with her God, praying for her children who are engaged in the uneven battle of life? Collectively and in our private lives, we are prone to take our mothers too much for granted. Will the day never come when we shall cease hero worshiping the military leaders of destruction and begin paying our long-delayed respects to the mother leaders of life? Recently, an American mother wrote a letter which inspired an unusual editorial, which appeared in the San Francisco Examiner and reads as follows. Those who possess the awful power to put this country into war should ponder deeply over a letter written to the editor of the Examiner by an American mother, commending the efforts of the Hearst newspapers to keep the United States out of another costly foreign war. The letter said, "We mothers of sons certainly do not wish to ever become Gold Star Mothers, someday to be granted that great boon of a trip across the ocean to shed futile tears before little white crosses in France, and merely because another rash, visionary president may deem it the high idealistic thing to do to conscript our boys and send them overseas to pour out their hearts' blood on the ungrateful fields of some foreign land." That recalls something some of our people have forgotten, and that some of our younger people probably never knew. Some years after the World War, the government of the United States suddenly remembered that for each boy who died for his country in that conflict, there was a mother who died a thousand deaths, first in fearful waiting, and then in the knowledge of a dreadful fact. So a pathetic little band of American mothers went overseas as guests of the government to shed futile tears, as this letter reminds us, over little white crosses in France. That was a fine gesture, and the country should be very glad it was made. But it made up nothing to mothers who had lost their sons. Young men in the prime of life, mere boys with all life before them, had been taken from their homes to die. And the unanswered and unanswerable question in every Gold Star mother's heart was, why? 20 years after the World War, a majority of the American people were represented in a national poll of public opinion as being convinced that the entry of the United States into that struggle was a mistake. It is too late to do anything for the Gold Star mothers of the World War except to honor and respect them for a great sacrifice unselfishly and unquestionably made. But since the World War, a new generation of American mothers has raised another generation of young men with life before them, if their country remains at peace, and with death before them, if it goes to war. These recent weeks and months of world crisis have clouded these mothers' lives with a great fear. Is their country to make another mistake? Are they too to be gold star mothers? Are their sons to be taken out of their homes, out of schools and colleges, out of the useful and happy occupations of peaceful production, to pour out their hearts' blood on the ungrateful fields of some foreign soil? Oh, American mothers know how to make the supreme sacrifice for their country, as well as the young men of America know how to die bravely and unquestioningly when liberty and homeland and honor are at stake. When the time comes for American blood to be shed in the defense of this free land, there will be no holding back of valiant sons and heroic mothers, because tears must also be shed. Oh, but American mothers have a right to know that war, if it comes, is the last recourse of honor and security. And no emergency confronts the United States today that justifies the torment of American mothers' hearts with the fear that is now in them, or that justifies the sending of American boys to die on foreign battlefields. Let us today assure both mothers and sons that this time, there will be no mistake. And that while we stand ready to defend America at any cost, we will not be persuaded, beguiled, or paid to meddle in foreign affairs or participate in foreign wars. All the insincerity of those who prate of honor, of patriotism, of glory, while they propagandize our nation for another war, another bloodbath, another crucifixion of the mothers of America. Recently, the question of Britain's paying the war debt to the United States was raised in the House of Commons in England without reaction from the British government. Leslie Hoare Bidisha, England's war secretary, revealed that Britain plans to continue paying royalties on a patented gun manufactured in Czechoslovakia and used by the British Army, despite the German annexation of Czechoslovakia. Now, it happened that a member of Parliament asked whether Hoare Bidisha were aware that by so doing, England was increasing the financial strength of Germany, insofar as she continued to make these payments. Probably so, Hoare Bidisha replied, but it is not customary for this country to repudiate payments which have been legally contracted. What about America? Cried a member of Parliament. And Hoare Bidisha made no answer. What is insanity? Months ago, specifically in the year 1935, Mr. Roosevelt, our president, was urged to intervene in Mexico, where persecution and violence were demonstrated against the Christian religionists. Although the president rightfully expressed his indignation at the butchery
which was being conducted under the Cardina communist regime. He stated explicitly, quotations, "For my own part, however, I decline to permit this government to undertake a policy of interference in the domestic concerns of foreign governments and thereby jeopardize the maintenance of peaceful relations," unquote. Oh, no. Governments will not intervene when malicious men extinguish the lamp of faith in the minds of mothers' children. But they are quick to change their policies to catapult our nation into war, to multiply heartbroken mothers decorated with a gold star whenever the gold of bankers is jeopardized in London or Paris or Moscow or elsewhere. What insincerity. Oh, yes, gold star mothers, you shed your tears where crimson poppies grow. Poppies that have been crimsoned with the heart's blood of your sons. And the nameless mothers nurse in living death their other sons, in whose minds the lamp of reason has been extinguished as a result of the horrors of last war. I call your attention to the fact that in addition to the physical casualties of the World War, 350,300 American boys who lost their lives, there are today 68,898 mental cases in our hospitals as a result of our sad experience 20 years ago when boys were then accepted for duty by the government as sound physically and mentally as you and I. And today, they are pitiful human wrecks. And who among us bore the economic sufferings which came as an aftermath to war, as did our mothers? 10 million families, 10 million mothers forced to eke out an existence through the sad, lean years of this protracted man-made depression. 10 million mothers who worried day and night to keep the home fires burning. How many pantries have been destitute of food? How many tears have been shed because these guardians of the home lacked the wherewithal to purchase clothing, fuel and medicine for the flesh of their flesh? Oh, they are not gold star mothers. They are the Madonnas who still stand beneath the cross of this man-made Calvary, mothers of Christ's brothers who hear their children cry aloud to the victim of Calvary, said, "My God, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" Mother's Day touches more than the sentimental strings which are stretched upon the keyboard of human nature. A deep religious significance is attached to the proper appreciation of this feast. Obviously, it concerns our own mothers by recalling the tender care and beautiful devotion which they extended to us, their children. Oh, for most of us, many years have passed, leaving behind nothing but memories. The simple, humble home where we were cradled, the toys, the games, the boyhood friends we cherished, the old-fashioned parties where schoolmates gathered, the healthful chores which we performed, the periods of illness,
measles, cold, scarlet fever. And in every instance, there was our youthful mother, serving to the best of her ability, spending her life, her beauty, and her girlish vitality, that we might live. Oh, for many of us, kind death has come to reward with rest the tired hands, the worried mind, and the aching heart which our mothers sacrificed upon the altar of their children's happiness. For others of us, mothers have grown old. Golden hair has been silvered with winter's frost. Bright blue eyes are dim. Wherever she is, dead or alive, your mother and mine loves her children more than anyone else will ever love them. Then, too, my friends, there is the mother of Jesus Christ, our tainted nature's solitary boast. It was she who nursed her baby boy in Bethlehem's cave. It was she who presented her offspring in the temple. It was she who spun his first cloak, who healed his first wound, who prepared his first meal after he had begun to work in Joseph's carpenter shop. Yes, it was she who kissed him farewell when he left her widowed home to preach a gospel of love to an ungrateful people. It was she who stood beneath Calvary's cross. It was she who held her son's corpse in her arms when all else save a few friends had fled. Every mother in the world would have done the same as did Mary Immaculate had the opportunity been presented to her. Every mother would have become the mother of sorrows gladly if it were her boy who had been condemned to death in Pilate's hall, scourged, crowned with thorns, nailed to Calvary. Cross. Oh, yes, Calvary's cross. Christ came into the world, among other things, my friends, to establish the brotherhood of man and the fatherhood of God. There, hanging forlorn between heaven and earth, he turned to his mother and said, "Mother, behold thy son." And bending his head in the direction of John the Apostle, he added, "Son, behold thy mother." Mother's Day is Mary's day. She is the universal mother of mankind who participated in our redemption and salvation. She is the refuge of sinners who loves each one of us more than mortal pen can describe. She is our intercessor, begging before her son's throne for us, her prodigal children. Oh, yes, this is Mother's Day. Flowers, telegrams, letters, visits, these will mark this Mother's Day as we pay tribute to her whose flesh is our flesh. Perhaps, yes, perhaps we will pause to recollect the prayers our mother taught us. We will remember those little boyhood scenes when we knelt at our knees before our mother. We will remember the little night prayers we said. Oh, my son.
sons and daughters, brothers and sisters. How far afield have we gone from those beauteous days when once we were little princes and princesses playing at the throne of mother's knee. Gone are the jewels of virtue once ours. Gone is the diadem of purity once ours. Gone is that heart filled with the gold of love once ours. Oh, it's not too late on Mother's Day to recapture the old-fashioned virtues that made us more like our elder brother, Jesus Christ. How many of you in this audience long since have disavowed those virtues taught you by your mother? How many of you today will seek the silence of your bedroom and there kneel down as you bury your head in your pillow to tell God that as a gift to your mother and to the mother of mankind, you will become the boy or the girl that once you were? Oh, yes, Mother's Day. We will pause to recollect the prayers she taught, the virtue she instilled, the seeds of love she sowed in our hearts with every kiss. Perhaps we will plan to build a monument to Mother after all. But let it be a living monument. A living monument of your flesh and blood. A monument to her by practicing the virtues she taught us, by leading the life of godliness which she loved, and from a religious appreciation of Mother's Day, perhaps therefore all of us shall recapture the admiration and devotion which once we had for the Mother of God. We can't love Jesus Christ without loving his mother. Oh, sweet mother of the Word made flesh, pray for us now that we may rise glorious and immortal from our former lives, to pattern the rest of our days after those of our elder brother, and to reflect in our every action the characteristics of your sweet mother, of our sweet mother in heaven, and of our dear mother upon this earth. God bless you, my friends. God keep you. Good afternoon.
Ladies and gentlemen, the program to which you have listened is your program. It is supported entirely by your free will contributions and the proceeds derived from Social Justice Magazine. May we recommend this powerful national weekly for your reading. Write this week to Father Coughlin for a copy of the address to which you have listened. Bear in mind that those who are opposed to Christianity and to constitutional Americanism are working assiduously to have your reverend spokesman forced from the air. Address your letter to Reverend Charles E. Coughlin, Royal Oak, Michigan.